Chapter 13. A Million Noahs, A Million Arks. Nature is an infinite sphere of which the center is everywhere and the circumference is nowhere. Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and philosopher. In December 2007, the UN held its big climate change conference in Bali, and I decided to go both to observe the debate about what the world should do to confront global warming and to write about Indonesia's environmental challenges, the cutting down of its rainforests in particular. As I was coming from the Persian Gulf, I flew to Bali via Abu Dhabi, the capital of the United Arab Emirates. When I went to board the Etihad Airways flight at 2:30 a.m. in Abu Dhabi's teeming airport, the gate agent told me to take a seat because my section was boarding last. So I sat down by the window and watched as about 200 young Indonesian women, not one of whom was much more than 5 feet tall, boarded the plane, all carrying purses and wearing backpacks overflowing with clothing, shoes, and electronic equipment. They were obviously returning home after some kind of lengthy stay, and were bringing back gifts and stuff in every pocket and bag. "What do all these girls do?" I asked the well-dressed Indian businessman seated next to me. "They're all maids," he answered. He and I then fell into conversation. It turned out that he was a management consultant and was in the Gulf advising governments on how to improve productivity. We chatted about the impact of globalization on the region. Before long, we were comparing India and Indonesia, and finally, he turned back to that long line of Indonesian maids sneaking past us onto the plane. "Indonesia exports raw labor, not brains," he mused. "What the country should be doing," he added, "is educating its people better, so more of them could secure better jobs at home, and fewer of them would have to sell their manual labor abroad." I made a mental note of our conversation and filed it away for my next book on globalization. But shortly after arriving in Jakarta, I realized that those maids had a lot in common with Indonesia's trees, and that exporting raw labor and exporting raw trees were, at root, different manifestations of the same problem. I learned that from Barnabas Subu, the governor of Indonesia's forest-rich province of Papua. We were talking about trees, but we just as well could have been talking about maids. "So many Indonesians in his province," he explained, "have such low incomes and so little education that they are always tempted to chop down a tree in one of Papua's tropical forests and sell it to a local middleman for a few $100 so that local middleman can export it to China or Vietnam for a few hundred more dollars so a manufacturer in China or Vietnam can make it into finished furniture products for a few $1,000 so a furniture store in Tokyo, Los Angeles, or London can sell for a few more $1,000. Unless his people can get the education that will enable them to bring more knowledge and value-added skills to their work so that they can produce $10,000 worth of products from just one tree rather than sell 100 trees for $100 each, the illegal logging of Indonesia's rainforests will likely continue, no matter how many police you put on the case. We have to make sure we get a lot more value out of every tree we cut," said Subu. "Trees, maids, education, governance, economic development, they're all interconnected. And that is the point of this chapter. Just as we need to develop a system for clean energy generation, to get more growth from abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons, we also need to develop a global strategy for the preservation of our forests, oceans, rivers, and endangered biodiversity hotspots to enable smart growth that doesn't destroy our natural world. That strategy for preservation has to include legal, financial, and educational components, and we cannot get it up and running fast enough, especially in places like Indonesia. Strategies for generation and preservation go together. They both are necessary if we want growth to be sustainable in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded. While China's pollution has garnered much attention, we should be just as concerned about environmental degradation in Indonesia, and not just because of its big human population, 237 million and growing. Indonesia is the second richest country in the world in terms of terrestrial biodiversity, after Brazil, and first in terms of marine biodiversity. Though covering only 1.3% of the Earth's land surface, Indonesia's forests represent 10% of all the world's tropical forest cover and are home to 20% of all the world's species of flora and fauna, 17% of the world's bird species, and more than 25% of the world's fish species. Just 10 hectares in the Indonesian island of Borneo contains more different tree species than are found in all of North America, not to mention a raft of plants, insects, and animals that don't exist anywhere else on Earth. In fact, little Borneo, with less than 1% of the Earth's land surface, reportedly holds 6% of the world's total bird species, mammal species, and flowering plant species. The whole Caribbean has only about 1/10 the marine biodiversity of Indonesia, which sits at the confluence of the Indian Ocean, the South China Sea, and the Pacific Ocean, and is nourished by all three. But much of this biodiversity in Indonesia is now under threat. Shortly after I arrived in Jakarta, my friend Alfred Nakatsuma, who runs the biodiversity preservation programs for the United States Agency for International Development in Indonesia, remarked to me that Indonesia had been entered into Guinness World Records for having the fastest rate of deforestation in the world. Indonesia is now losing tropical forests the size of Maryland every year, and the carbon released by the cutting and clearing of all these trees, much of it done illegally, has made Indonesia the third largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the world, after the United States and China. Brazil is number four for the same reason. We tend to think of the climate issue as purely an energy problem. How do we reduce the number of gasoline cars we drive and the amount of coal we burn? But in Indonesia, climate is a forest problem. We think of the problem as being too many cars. They think of it as being too few trees. More than 70% of CO2 emissions from Indonesia come from the cutting and clearing of forests. According to Conservation International, a forest area the size of 300 soccer fields is cut down in Indonesia every hour. Illegal logging from national forests costs the Indonesian government $3 billion in lost state revenues each year. But even what is legal involves extensive deforestation as Indonesia tries to grow its economy by, understandably, selling forest products. Unfortunately, the trouble doesn't stop at the water's edge. The waters around the 17,000 islands of the Indonesian archipelago hold 14% of the Earth's coral reefs and more than 2,000 coral reef fish species. Corals are people, too, jokes Mark Erdman, the marine biologist and senior advisor to Conservation International in Indonesia. We often forget that corals are both plants and animals, he added, and the main thing they provide is shelter and structure and substrate, like trees in the forest. No more trees, no more leopards or orangutans, no more corals, no more fish. But runaway development and both dynamite and cyanide fishing have imperiled many of Indonesia's coral reefs, which provide the critical habitat for fish and other reef animals. A Western diplomat in Jakarta who follows biodiversity issues told me that one Indonesian fishing fleet company had informed him that in the year 2000, 8% of its catch from the waters around Indonesia were small baby fish, and that by 2004, that number was 34%. As this diplomat put it, when you are into one-third babies, the end is near. Imagine a world without forests. Imagine a world without coral. Imagine a world without fish. Imagine a world where rivers run only in the rainy season. Not only is that possible in more and more places, it is possible in our lifetime if we don't develop a system for preservation of biodiversity and natural resources that is as smart, comprehensive, and effective as the system we are trying to develop for clean power generation. Of course, lots of people offer quick fix plans for how to stem the tide of biodiversity degradation, but in countries like Indonesia, plans are rarely implemented as intended. While attending the Bali Climate Change Conference, I came across an article in the Jakarta Post, December 11, 2007, that described what usually happens instead. The author, Andrio Adiwibowo, a lecturer in environmental management at the University of Indonesia, wrote about a smart plan to protect the mangrove forests around coastal Jakarta. Even for many biologists, mangrove forests are still viewed as wastelands. Yet the tidal flood late last month in Jakarta reminds us that if we don't respect these saltwater-tolerant plant communities, it can turn our backyards into the wasteland. Approximately 14 years ago, a team from the Ecology Laboratory at the Biology Department, School of Mathematical and Natural Sciences, University of Indonesia, made environmental assessments on the coastal areas of Jakarta and warned of the possibility of tidal floods. The suggested solution was first to maintain mangroves as the core zone, and second, to provide a buffer zone. Based on forestry regulations and conservation laws, the vegetation in this buffer zone should consist 60% of native mangrove plants, and the rest, plants that can be utilized by the surrounding people. If the plan is implemented, a repeat of the recent floods can be avoided. Nevertheless, the plan was not implemented. Instead of providing a buffer zone, development encroached into the core zone, which was covered over by concrete. Nevertheless, the plan was not implemented. That is such a common refrain when it comes to preservation of species, coral reefs, fish, mangroves, and our tropical forests. Governor Subu of Papua seemed to be well aware of this tendency. His own motto, he told me, was, "Think big, start small, act now." But act how? Now that we know the world's biodiversity is under greater threat than ever in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, what is the comprehensive strategy, not just a one-off plan, that can work for preservation? The short answer? We need a million Noahs and a million arks. In our whole existence as a species, we have had the luxury of assuming that the Earth's plant and animal bounty was inexhaustible. But since the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, there has been a growing global consensus that the Earth's changing climate, our patterns of resource consumption, and our soaring population are combining to threaten the very web of biodiversity that sustains all species, including and especially our own. And therefore, we need to redefine our relationship with the natural world. As I have argued in the previous chapters, energy use, economic growth, species loss, deforestation, petropolitics, and global warming are all interconnected. Rapid economic growth and population expansion, flat meets crowded, is driving the destruction of forests and other ecosystems at an unprecedented rate. The destruction of these forests and biodiversity-rich environments, in turn, contributes to climate change. Flat and crowded meet hot and make it hotter by releasing more carbon into the atmosphere. Moreover, this destruction of forests and other natural habitats, like coral reefs, makes us more vulnerable as humans, because the trees in the forests soak up that clean rainwater and store it beneath the surface in roots and aquifers and manage the water's release into rivers and streams. And because coral reefs and mangroves buffer coastal areas against tropical storms. In other words, the further we get into the energy climate era, the more we need natural habitats, forests that can hold the soil in place and provide homes for endangered species, and healthy reefs to protect coastal areas from being swamped by sea level rise and to nourish the fishing stocks that provide so much food for coastal peoples. Generating abundant, clean, reliable, and cheap electrons would certainly help to take pressure off the world's most endangered ecosystems, but it would not be sufficient. We also need a comprehensive strategy to stimulate preservation at scale, to ensure that more plants, animals, and people would have the resources they need to survive. And that strategy needs to be driven and maintained first and foremost by the people who live in and around our most valuable natural resources. It takes an ecosystem of the right government policies, the right investments, and the right actors to save an ecosystem of plants, animals, and forests. Each of these ecosystems for preservation will be different, depending on the country and the place that needs protection. And each one I call an ark. Noah had one ark to save the world's biodiversity in his day, and we need a million of them to save the biodiversity in ours. Each ark has to include the following components. 1. A national government policy to set aside certain protected areas that are off-limits for exploitation, conversion, or development because of their biodiversity importance, while at the same time delineating other areas that can be developed for economic growth and managed carefully to protect endangered species, water quality, and other ecological values. 2. Economic opportunities for the local community that enable it to thrive without harming the area's biodiversity. 3. Private sector investors, be they hoteliers, energy or mining companies, agribusinesses, tourism developers, or others who have an interest in keeping the area's biodiversity intact and can attract global investment in projects that can make a profit, respect the natural world, and help raise local living standards all at once. 4. A local government that is able and willing to preserve protected areas and not sell them off to the highest bidders or allow itself to be corrupted by logging or mining interests. 5. Local or international experts who know how to do proper biodiversity assessments and land use planning to determine precisely which areas need to be protected and which can be developed with proper environmental safeguards. 6. Initiatives to improve primary and secondary education, so young people develop knowledge skills that make it less necessary for them to plunder the natural world around them. While the elements of each arc need to be tailored to each setting, in every case, the people involved in each arc have to understand that keeping the local ecosystem intact is in their interest. They have to be invested in preserving the protected areas and the overall biodiversity of the region. If any one of them is missing in action, the odds of success will be much lower. But there is no ark without a Noah, In every instance, you need a Noah who is able to pull together this coalition, this ecosystem, by helping everyone see his or her self-interest in its preservation. These Noahs can be local government officials, conservationists, or leaders in businesses or non-governmental organizations. They can and should come in all shapes and sizes and personality types, as different and varied as the different environmental problems and the different economic interests that need to be addressed and pulled together in each ecosystem. That's why, if we are going to preserve our natural world in the age of hot, flat, and crowded, we are going to need a million Noahs and a million arks. There are many discussions going on today at the United Nations and the World Bank about how developed countries can transfer money to developing countries to, in effect, pay them not to chop down their tropical forests. Many hope that such a mechanism will be part of the next post-Kyoto treaty to govern climate change. Such global initiatives, while well-intended, in my view, will not work without these local arcs. Anyone who thinks they will does not understand the complexity of biodiversity preservation. If I've learned anything about ecology in researching this book, it is this: all conservation is local. That is, global treaties and financing mechanisms are necessary, but by themselves, they won't even come close to solving the problem. You need coalitions on the ground bound together by an interlocking web of self-interests to preserve a certain pristine region or forest. We need to spend as much time and effort helping developing countries nurture these ecosystems on the ground as we do negotiating what treaty provisions should stipulate. Every global dollar is only as valuable and useful in preserving biodiversity as the quality of the Noah and the strength of his or her ark on the ground. Some say the key to solving our energy problem is just one really smart Thomas Edison, one inventor who can come up with that magic breakthrough to generate abundant, clean, reliable, cheap power. Maybe. But the key to solving our biodiversity problem is 1 million Noahs with 1 million arks. What does an ark actually look like? I visited one in March 2008. It looks like a meeting in a ramshackle wooden schoolhouse in a remote village on the edge of a tropical forest in North Sumatra, Indonesia. The village is called Ayak Nabara, and it is located next to the Batang Toru Tropical Forest, 375,000 acres of trees and wildlife, much of which the government in Jakarta had auctioned off as a logging concession to the highest bidder. The villagers were worried about what was going to happen to the forest, which has been a source of both spiritual and material livelihood to the people of the area for as far back as they could remember. These villagers did not have college degrees, but they knew their interests, though they didn't always know how to defend them. The day I visited, with a team from Conservation International and the U.S. Ambassador to Indonesia, Cameron R. Hume, the entire village turned out to tell their story. Men and boys, women in batiks with babies wrapped to their hips, young and old, all gathered in the village square for an impromptu town hall meeting. Only men, though, were actually allowed into the schoolhouse to a session chaired by the village's four leaders, three of whom were wearing traditional Indonesian peci caps, the kind President Suharto made famous. Seated next to these elders, though, was a bearded younger man wearing a green Australian bush hat. But what made him memorable was not his hat. It was the fact that on his shoulder he had a tiny 8-month-old rust-furred orangutan, which he was feeding from a baby bottle. It wasn't the sort of thing you usually see in the front row of a town hall meeting. It turns out, I soon discovered, that baby orangutan, an orphan that had been found in the forest next to the village a week earlier, was the key to the whole story. That's because the Noah of Batang Toru is Dr. Jatna Supriyatna, a 55-year-old bespectacled professor of bioanthropology at the University of Indonesia who runs Conservation International's Indonesia programs. One of Supriyatna's specialities is the endangered orangutan, the species of great apes found today only in the Indonesian tropical forests of Sumatra and Borneo, and distinguished by their great intelligence, rusty orange hair, and long swinging arms. Those long arms come in handy, as the orangutan is the largest tree-dwelling mammal in the world, and they use both legs and arms to swing, like Tarzan, from tree to tree in the forest. According to zoologists, the word orangutan is derived from the Indonesian and Malaysian words for person, orang, and forest, hutan, and means person of the forest. A century ago, there were over 300,000 orangutans living in the wilds of Indonesia and Malaysia. Since then, more than 90% of the population has been wiped out, many in the last decade and a half. In 2004, Supriyatna persuaded one of his students to write her master's thesis on the question of whether there were actually any orangutans left at all in the southern part of the province of North Sumatra. There had been rumors of an orangutan sighting in the Batang Toru tropical forest, adjacent to Aik Nabara, but they had not been confirmed. The forest is also home to Sumatran tigers and pythons, and to avoid them, the Sumatran orangutans almost never walk on the forest floor, making them difficult to spot. His student, explained Supriyatna, spent 6 months in Batang Toru and concluded that there were 12 orangutans living in the tropical forest there. So I started thinking, how do we save these animals? There are only 4,000 to 5,000 Sumatran orangutans left. The orangutans are important for keeping the forest healthy. They are voracious eaters of termites and fruit, particularly sugar palm, the seeds of which they spread across the forest floor, helping to keep it forested. By coincidence, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont had recently pushed through a budget increase to the United States Agency for International Development for the specific purpose of helping to save the endangered orangutans of Indonesia. So, USAID granted Conservation International $1 million to hire scientists to survey Batang Toru to determine exactly how many orangutans were living there and to design a program for saving them. They started surveying in 2005. We eventually came up with 350 to 400, a big number in Batang Toru alone, said Supriyatna. We also used some of the money to start talking to people in communities on the edge of the jungle. We took them into the jungle and showed them how the orangutans were living next to them. They said, "Wow, we didn't even know they were here." They knew their grandparents had mentioned them, but they had never seen any their entire lives. Next, Supriyatna studied how the villagers themselves regulated their use of the forest and drew up an economic evaluation of how much money they made or could make from different activities if the forest was to remain intact, from growing and selling cocoa, cloves, cinnamon, and rubber, either on the edge of the forest or on the forest floor, and, most profitably, from selling the geothermal power, which the village had a claim to, that naturally bubbles on the forest hillsides from old volcanic formations. We basically concluded that if the orangutan was to survive, the tropical forest had to survive, Supriyatna explained, and the only way that was going to happen was if the villagers understood how much they benefited from the forest, not to mention the rest of us. Just a few words about these huge trees that sustain us all. All along the equator stretching both north and south over land surfaces, is a wide belt of tropical forests. These range from rainforests, where it rains all year round, to seasonally moist forests, which get lots of rainfall but only in certain seasons, to drier woodland forests. Although tropical forests cover only about 7% of the Earth's dry land, they probably harbor about half of all species on Earth, notes NASA's Earth Observatory report on tropical deforestation by Rebecca Lindsay, March 30, 2007. Tropical forests are also home to millions of native, indigenous people who make their livings through subsistence agriculture, hunting and gathering, or through low-impact harvesting of forest products like rubber or nuts. While oceans are still the primary lungs of the world, storing and exhaling CO2, tropical forests also play a critical role in the carbon cycle and in moderating global warming. Carbon is abundantly present in the Earth's atmosphere in the form of carbon dioxide. Although only a tiny portion of our overall atmosphere, this carbon dioxide is critical in supporting plant, animal, and human life. Plants live, grow, and thrive by taking sunlight and, through photosynthesis, converting carbon dioxide into carbohydrates, giving off oxygen in the process. This process is most intense in younger forests, where trees are still shooting up into the sky. Plants and trees incorporate the associated carbon atoms into sugars and other molecules in order to grow. Plants use some of these sugars to generate energy in a process called respiration, which returns carbon atoms back to the atmosphere in the form of CO2, notes SafeClimate.net. So, intact tropical forests both absorb and give off CO2. However, much of the carbon absorbed remains locked up in the plant's biomass until decomposition, logging, or fires release it back to the atmosphere. Old-growth forests, in particular, store vast amounts of carbon while continuing to absorb CO2, which is why maintaining these forests is so critical for combating climate change. In the Amazon alone, according to the NASA study, scientists estimate that the trees contain more carbon than 10 years' worth of human-produced greenhouse gases from driving and manufacturing. It noted, "When people clear the forests, usually with fire, carbon stored in the wood returns to the atmosphere, enhancing the greenhouse effect and global warming. In places such as Indonesia, the soils of swampy lowland forests are rich in partially decayed organic matter known as peat. During extended droughts, the forests and the peat become flammable, especially if they have been degraded by logging or accidental fire. When they burn, they release huge volumes of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases." Wanting to preserve the Batang Toru Forest for the sake of biodiversity in general, the villagers, the orangutan, and the climate, Supriyatna decided to organize separate workshops with all the stakeholders in and around this vast expanse of trees. So he met separately with the local mining company, the villagers, and the loggers who owned the forest concession, as well as a big energy investor who wanted to tap the area's geothermal pockets. The energy investor was one of Indonesia's richest men, Arifin Panigoro, the founder of Medco Energy Internasional, a big local oil and gas drilling company, and a very unlikely green. He had leased the geothermal concession from the government in the middle of the Batang Toru Forest in 2006. When Supriyatna came to see him, Panigoro told me, he was very wary. "I had never heard of Conservation International. I thought it was like Greenpeace. I said to myself, who is this guy?" It took a few conversations, but eventually Supriyatna persuaded Panigoro that he had as much, if not more, of a stake in maintaining the forest as the villagers. Panagoro needed the forest in order to maintain the watershed, so that the water table required to sustain the geothermal wells would not fall so low that the hot rocks couldn't generate steam. Panagoro may not have been an environmentalist when he met Supriyatna, but he was a savvy businessman who loved his country and realized that its natural resources were now being radically depleted. 20 years back, we didn't have these problems, he told me. We had huge tropical forests, and they continued to cut the trees at the time. They considered it sustainable, but it wasn't. Panagoro eventually agreed to join Conservation International's Indonesian Advisory Board and to use his resources to try to buy the logging concession for the Batang Toru Tropical Forest from the timber company that owned it and turn it into a protected area free from development except controlled agroforestry and his ongoing geothermal project. As of the recording of this program, he was still in negotiations. Buying the concession will cost about $2 million, but the Indonesian logging company appeared amenable to a sale because most of this forest is on steep hillsides where it was finding it hard to cut and remove trees. Once Panagoro has the forest under his control, he plans to go ahead with the geothermal energy project. He hopes to produce 330 megawatts and look for ways to partner with the locals in controlled agriculture on the forest floor and maybe in ecotourism. The power will go to nearby towns in Sumatra. Supriyatna's Conservation International team helped to broker a deal whereby the villagers will get a royalty from the geothermal plant, once it is up and running, to support their local school and infrastructure. Meanwhile, Shanghai-based Giti Tire, China's largest tire manufacturer, looking to voluntarily offset its carbon emissions, has agreed to plant rubber trees to create a buffer zone of sustainable agroforestry around the edge of the forest, which will protect the trees, produce rubber for tires, and provide additional livelihoods for the villagers, explained Enki Tan, a company director who is also a member of the Conservation International Board. Giti Tire plans to feature this eco-friendly rubber in its tire ads. Supriyatna's team also worked with the indigenous villagers to revive their own traditional oral laws, called Adat, which put a high premium on protecting the forests, rivers, and the whole natural environment, which, in previous generations, sustained these little communities. They were resurrecting the values of their grandparents, which had gotten lost with the new generation watching too much television, even though they lived next to the forest, said Supriyatna, who also trained a force of 25 men to form an orangutan patrol, paying them a small stipend each month to tend to the animals and ward off any poachers. The guy in the bush hat feeding the baby orangutan, which had been tossed out of the nest by its mother, was wearing the official shirt of the local orangutan patrol. At their presentation to the U.S. ambassador, the villagers seemed cautiously optimistic that their locally built ark would work. They proudly displayed jars full of products they were already growing on the rainforest floor, including cinnamon, cloves, and sugar palm. One thing we learned from Conservation International, one of the village elders explained in his presentation, was how to manage which areas are good for agroforestry and which ones are not. We are cut off. We did not know how to make a better living. Rather than coming in and lecturing the villagers on how and why they should save the orangutan, which wasn't going to make a big impression on people so poor they could barely save themselves, Supriyatna started by working with them to make their village a better place to live and to see the forest around them as something they had a collective interest in preserving. Saving the orangutan was a byproduct of that. "We always start by looking at the local power structure," said Supriyatna. understanding the local communities, their cultures, their social and economic aspects, and the influence of the business sector, and focusing on what was in it for them and not just the orangutan. If the orangutan benefits and the community doesn't, we lose the foundation for protecting the whole. Supriyatna said that lately his academic colleagues have started to ask him, "Are you becoming a political ecologist?" They are worried that I am going away from hard-nosed biology, he said. But I believe that conservation is not just about protecting the tigers and just looking at how they behave and their food and their predators. Conservation is also about dealing with people. We are the ones disturbing nature. You need to know the biology, but you can't stop with that and assume that it is all going to be fine. A lot of government officials just look at a map, draw a protected area totally disconnected from the living reality, and assume that an arc of preservation will grow there just like the vegetation. It doesn't happen that way. No people, said Supriyatna, no conservation. Supriyatna used a similar formula, beginning in 2003, to build a very different arc in the nearby Batang Gadis tropical forest, where he and his team were able to help get 270,000 acres set aside as a national park in 2004 by then-Indonesian President Megawati Sukarnoputri. Supriyatna's strategy there was to leverage the local Islamic school, the Mustafawiya Madrasa, which had 7,500 students. He began by approaching the school's imam, its top spiritual leader, and explaining to him that the river running through his school property would get polluted with tailings if a proposed gold mine upstream in the Batang Gadis forest was to go ahead as planned. The river would also get clogged with silt if logging was allowed. The mine had been licensed to dig right into the water catchment area, and Supriyatna and his team wanted to have it relocated. But they needed local allies. So he explained to the imam that the river that his students depended upon to wash themselves before prayer 5 times a day was about to get very, very dirty. It is not enough just to tell them the forest is nice, said Supriyatna. I told him, you will not be able to do your ritual washing if this river is polluted. The imam was skeptical at first, recalled Supriyatna. He said to me, this is just your prediction. The river can't be polluted. We have been here 50 years. I said, do you know there is mining starting upstream? And he said, it is far away. So I said, come with me. I will take you to the mine. So I and my staff took him to the mine. He could see the impact with his own eyes. He came back and went straight to the Bupati, the district head, and asked that the forest be protected. Added Supriyatna, if you influence the imam, he will influence all the kids, and all the kids will tell all the parents. It was the first time the Bupati, whose name was Amru Daule, had encountered a bottom-up environmental movement. He looked at this movement and said, this is very powerful, recalled Supriyatna. So Supriyatna started to work on him for a bigger project, to help turn Batang Gadis into a national park that no one could touch. The Bupati asked me, how can we afford to turn it into a national park? And how do we compensate people who benefit from the logging and mining? Supriyatna built his case around the river and the fact that its water irrigated 100,000 acres of rice paddies, all of which would be imperiled if the river was polluted by logging or mining. By coincidence, at the time, Indonesia was moving to devolution of power from the central government in Jakarta to the outlying regions. The Bupati, who had originally been appointed by the central government in Jakarta to head the Medina district, was going to have to run for office for the first time. I said to him, "You can be a hero," recalled Supriyatna. Amru Dale did the political math and realized that if he sent the letter to the Ministry of Forestry asking to declare Batangadis a national park, it could serve him well in his first real election, which is exactly what he did. Needless to say, it took a lot of other lobbying and negotiating by groups like Conservation International, the local Islamic leadership, and other Indonesian environmentalists before the government created the park. It is not something that just one district boss can engineer with one letter. But in the end, it did get done, and Dale did not hesitate to base his first campaign, in part, on having helped to get the forest protected and the mining company to relocate its operation outside the watershed. By the way, he won. Alas, this is not always the pattern, to say the least. In Indonesia, the move to democracy and decentralization has had mixed effects on environmental conservation. In some parts of the country, provincial and even district governments have strengthened conservation, as Governor Subu has done in Papua. But in other areas, newly empowered local governments, with no supervision anymore from Jakarta, have gorged themselves with opportunities to make quick money by selling permits to extract natural resources, thereby making formerly illegal extractors legal. Supriyatna told me that the coalitions he has helped to build around Batang Toru and Batang Gadis remind him of a sandwich with so many layers: cheese, tomatoes, meat, potatoes, the government, the communities, the scientists, and the private sector. It has to be adapted to what the problems are. When you talk with the head of the government, your language is economic. When you talk to the communities, the language is welfare. When you talk to business, you talk about their future profits. When you talk to other NGOs, the language is environment. There have to be different arcs and different NOAAs for different regions and different folks. There is simply no other way we can hope to achieve success. But no ecosystem to promote healthier forests will survive for long without better educated people. The two go hand in hand. The village elders who came out to speak to us in Ayak Nabara boasted that they finally had opened a library. I stopped in to see it, a mound of dusty books and magazines piled onto a table. It was sad. Ultimately, the most sustainable way to save the forest is to create knowledge jobs. If you want to save the forests, you have to save the people first. And in today's world, the only way to do that is with an education through which people can learn service or manufacturing skills that do not involve plundering the forest. At a minimum, you want people to leave the tropical forest alone, and at a maximum, you want them actively protecting it, either for touristic or medicinal or sustainable agriculture purposes. Unfortunately, Indonesia, one of my favorite countries in the world, with an uncommonly likable people and a stunning landscape, has never given education the priority it needs, probably because the country always had so many natural resources to tap. Although Indonesia has 237 million citizens, only 6,000 have PhDs, an extremely low percentage. It spends more money today subsidizing gasoline and cooking oil products for its people, 30% of the national budget, than providing them with an education, 6% of the national budget. Not a good trade. So, if you go to Indonesia in 10 years and see plane loads of young women being shipped out to be maids, you can be sure the trees will be gone too. While each of these arcs has to be built locally, with local investment and local players and local self-interest, global financing is critical. Because with the power of the global economy today, the amounts of money being put up for oil palm plantations and soy plantations and raw timber are so high that in too many places, the forests are obviously worth more in the short term cut down than standing. If you just look at the price a villager or a logging company can get today for chopping down a tree, as opposed to what they might earn protecting it, it's easy to see why the forest loses. And when you think what a big logging company can get from clear-cutting a vast area, it's even more frightening. That is why these arcs cannot exist in isolation, and why we cannot leave these NOAAs to fend for themselves. Rarely are there enough resources locally to generate the alternative incomes and to build the alternative investments to exploiting the forest. 90% of the people living in extreme poverty around the world today are directly dependent upon forests for their food, fuel, shelter, fresh water, and fiber, notes Michael Totten, the Conservation International expert on climate, water, and ecosystems. And most of these people live in rural areas. Many of them are also indigenous peoples whose cultures will not survive if the forests don't survive. There has to be an international system to support whatever arcs local communities build, whether via traditional foreign aid programs like USAID or other mechanisms that have been effective in providing the resources, technical expertise, and political pressure to launch these arcs. This is not just a charity. It is also national security, notes Alfred Nakatsuma of USAID. Many conflicts are created by the destruction of natural resources that are necessary for the livelihoods of people living in natural ecosystems. One recent USAID study indicated that within a 6-kilometer radius of large-scale deforestation in Indonesia, 40% of the communities had natural resource-based conflicts. Conflict over water is happening on an increasingly broad basis, and this often is created by mismanagement of aquifers, poor upstream forestry practices, and industrial domestic pollution problems. So, good environmental practices also reduce conflict and security problems within nations and across their borders. That is why proposals like REDD, which try to assign a value to the tropical forests for the environmental services they provide in order to compete with the value that the commodity markets assign to them, are so important. REDD stands for Reduced Emissions from Deforestation and Forest Degradation, and environmentalists want to see the concept included in the UN's successor treaty to Kyoto. Under the REDD proposal, wealthy developed countries would pay poor developing countries to keep their forests intact. In return, the developed nations would get carbon credits that they could count against their emissions reduction requirements under any new climate treaty. Figuring out how to calculate these credits will be difficult, but even more difficult will be ensuring that this doesn't just end up with one government's central bank transferring money to another while the forests get cut down anyway. You need to be able to track every dollar from the first donor down to the last NOAA and make sure those funds do not only go into government accounts, but into credible arcs built one at a time. Otherwise, we will end up with a lot of leaky arcs and continued deforestation and rising carbon dioxide emissions. All conservation is local, but all our locals are increasingly connected. The palm oil that fried up your French fries today may have come from a chopped-down tropical forest in Indonesia, which, in turn, helped to contribute to climate change that is intensifying the drought in your backyard. That is why deforestation is everyone's problem, and investing in abating it is potentially to everyone's benefit. The world's long-term health depends on healthy ecosystems, said Glenn Prickett of Conservation International. The future will not be secure if we just find clean electrons and get rid of molecules of CO2. We need healthy forests and clean rivers and productive soils just as much. We need to care for them in their own right and invest in them directly. In the dirty fuel system, people simply took it for granted that economic growth was a trade-off between the health of the ecosystem and the economic health of a community, and that the extinction of species like the orangutan was an inevitable but necessary byproduct, an externality, in the language of economics. Under a clean energy system, we will understand that healthy ecosystems and healthy economies have to go together. Otherwise, the growth itself will be undermined by degraded or insufficient natural resources. The survival of the orangutan is not just a nice byproduct. It is the sign that your model is successful, said Prickett. But at some point, we also need to get beyond these economic and even practical arguments and get back in touch with the deepest truth of all. Green is a value that needs to be preserved in and of itself, not because it is going to make your bank account richer, but because it makes life richer and always has. At the end of the day, that is what an ethic of conservation is also about. An ethic of conservation declares that maintaining our natural world is a value that is impossible to quantify, but also impossible to ignore because of the sheer beauty, wonder, joy, and magic that nature brings to being alive. Clean electrons are necessary. Dramatic improvements in energy efficiency are necessary. But the preservation of nature can't be asked to compete with them on purely economic grounds, although it actually can when you add up all the services that nature provides that aren't valued in the marketplace. It must be appreciated, revered, and preserved as a value apart and above all things economic and practical. If we do not nurture this green value in our children, then the cleaner our economies get and the more energy efficient they become, the more effectively and efficiently we will rape the natural world. There will be no hard walls to stop it. People don't preserve what they don't respect or revere. That's why I believe strongly in programs like No Child Left Indoors, sponsored by the Ecological Society of America, the nation's premier organization of ecological scientists. The idea behind No Child Left Indoors Week, part of the annual Earth Week, is to develop a greater awareness among schoolchildren and their families of the web of nature right out their back doors, and to encourage students and their families to learn how to be good stewards of their larger home, planet Earth. The ESA website, ESA.org, notes that statistics show that visits to national and state parks have fallen off by as much as 25% in the last decade, as kids remain indoors watching TV and playing computer games. A recent scientific study, it noted, found that more children knew the characters of Pokemon, an electronic game.